March 28th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. So what do we have on the show today, Jess?
We speak with Greg Epstein, who is a humanist chaplain at Harvard University, and he talks about what his job entails and also about an upcoming conference that Harvard will be hosting.
And I believe you are working on an intergenerational conversation between feminists who are also lesbians.
That's right, Duncan. And we will also introduce the Institute's new legislative liaison.
Our new humanist lobbyist.
That's right.
For those of you just tuning in, humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion.
There's actually been a lot about humanism in the news lately, right, Duncan? Some good news.
There's been some good news, and there's been some bad news. First, the good news, for those of you who've been tuning in, we've talked to Lori Lipman Brown a few times from the Secular Coalition for America. That's a national lobbying organization that represents humanists and other freethinkers. The SCA hosted a contest for people to identify the highest ranking elected official who was a non-theist, someone who does not believe in a god. So someone nominated Congressman Pete Stark from California. He did fill out a questionnaire, and he did describe his worldview as he's a Unitarian, but he does not believe in a supreme being. I called Congressman Stark's office to request an interview with the H&N podcast. Unfortunately, he has yet to accept our invitation. I did speak with his press secretary, who told me that the congressman is very hesitant to do interviews about this topic because he does believe firmly in the separation of church and state, and he doesn't want to espouse his own personal beliefs on religion, just the same as he doesn't want fundamentalist or evangelical politicians to spout off about their religious beliefs. So maybe he'll speak with us in the future, but we did try. So congratulations to Pete Stark. There's been a lot of good press about it, actually. Comes from he's from the Bay Area, so it's a fairly liberal area. So it's not too shocking that if someone is going to be out about it, that's the place where you might be, but out comfortably. You can visit www.secular.org to learn more about Congressman Pete Stark, and also you can send a letter congratulating him. Let him know that you're glad that he's open and honest about his worldview. We had some negative press, not as national. The Pete Stark story was a national story that was everywhere. This one, not so many places.
Right. Well,
but, happened to be in Albany, where we live.
Right. As we mentioned last month, we were hoping to interview Kirk Cameron on his show and, maybe speak to some bands or something for our Breakout Through segment.
Yeah.
However, my partner in crime has not been available. He hasn't been at my dispense because, he's been a little preoccupied and riled up. Yes,
I have been.
About this column that appeared in our local newspaper, Duncan.
Yeah, it's a syndicated column by Suzanne Field. She writes for the Washington Times, which is a religious right wing paper, basically. It's not picked up in that many places, but the Albany Times Union, our local paper, which is a great newspaper, ran her column in the opinion section. And I know it wasn't written by the newspaper, and I know that they try to run a variety of opinions, but I feel like Suzanne Field's column took a lot of unnecessary swipes at the atheist worldview, made a lot of false accusations. She implied that we're the devil,
basically.
For one. She linked us to Nazism, which is historically inaccurate. The Nazis were not atheists. And she threw in little canards like, there are no atheists in foxholes. And I really felt like it was gratuitous insults flung at atheists. I just feel like, I don't think the Times Union would have published, a column that made similar swipes at another group.
Right.
We grabbed Matt Sherry to speak about this earlier today, and here's what he had to say. Matt, can you explain to us what this column said and can you explain why I'm so upset about this column?
Well, I'm glad you're upset because I thought it was just me, and I read this at breakfast and I was apoplectic, and I'm not normally that riled up, especially at breakfast, but it was a column by Suzanne Fields, and I was reading it in the Times Union on, I think, March the 13th. And Suzanne Fields is a right-wing religious columnist for the Washington Times, and her column is syndicated in a few other papers. I'm not sure it's a ton of papers.
I actually called the company that syndicates her, and they said that they couldn't tell me who her clients were, but it was about half a dozen papers, mostly in the Northeast.
That was probably why they couldn't tell you, because it's so few that they don't want to look like it's unpopular.
Right.
It certainly is unpopular with me. It was just a terrible column. It wasn't even well written, which I suppose we should be grateful for, because its purpose was to bash atheists. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people said its purpose was to bash Democrats, which is probably true, but it was bashing Democrats by tarring them with the atheist brush. Mm-hmm. And it starts off by saying there are no atheists in foxholes, which is, we all know, is a lie. And it's really a lie designed to sort of suggest that if you don't believe in God, you're non-belief is weak and, you know, mm-hmm. will collapse under the first sign of pressure.
Mm-hmm. It also implies, though, that atheists are cowardly and that aren't patriotic.
Right.
Because they're not doing their duty by serving the country.
But it also implies the only people shooting each other in foxholes are believing in God. So maybe it's a positive thing for the non-religious. But it wasn't intended that way by her. She was trying to say that just slander atheists. Mm-hmm. And the rest of her column was in a similar vein. She was attacking the newfound religiosity of many Democrats, which I'd be happy to attack. Mm-hmm. But she was doing so by implying that they weren't genuinely religious. They were somehow closet atheists, or they were
God deniers, she called them.
God deniers.
Secular prophets, God deniers.
Not true Christians, anyway. And she was basically attacking them by suggesting that they might be secular or sympathetic to atheists. Mm-hmm.
So, Matt, the first thing you did was you penned a letter to the Times Union articulating why you feel that it's not fair, it's inappropriate that they would publish this column.
I did, and I think it was a good letter, but I then thought, this is, you know, whatever insult is hurled at us, we reply with like a reasonable, well-written letter to the editor.
Right.
And sometimes that's not enough.
Yeah.
And I don't like groups who go around like trying to boycott the media, or it's kind of editorial vigilantism where they're threatening, you know, the newspaper that they shouldn't publish this kind of thing. But I do feel in some cases where it's not a reasoned criticism of humanist beliefs, but it's an attack on all non-believers.
Right.
As a group, that it's just hate speech and we should reply accordingly.
Well, your basic point is that in the past, all these atheist groups and the Institute for Humanist Studies has written very rational letters swatting down this hate speech, but really we shouldn't even be engaging in this discussion. Why are we giving them the time of day to give them a rational response to irrational, just mean-spirited hate speech, right?
Right. I mean, if they're making an argument against our beliefs, then we should respond reasonably. Mm-hmm. But if they're attacking us as a group, we can still respond reasonably, but we should also tell newspapers that they wouldn't attack any other group like this, that it's accepted that to pick on a group as a group and to defame them as a group is no longer acceptable. They used to be able to do that 20 years ago in mainstream newspapers about gays and lesbians, and they still do it in a lot of right-wing or extremist newspapers.
Yeah.
But the mainstream has moved on from there and knows that you should be ashamed when you attack a group like that.
Well, just recently, Ann Coulter, the right-wing columnist, was insulting John Edwards by calling him gay. Now, she wasn't...
she didn't use such a positive word, but...
Yeah. No, she called him a faggot, and there's been a lot of discussion about this. I mean, it's a slur. So I understand. I was trying to articulate to the news editors of the Times Union why this is a similar situation, but, you know, I feel like, no, atheist isn't a slur the way faggot is, but let's just say that she called him gay instead. She might not have been intending to insult homosexuals, but that is an insult. I mean, to use... To call someone gay as an insult is insulting to the person you're insulting, but is it or is it not also insulting to people who are gay?
Well, on behalf of all the gay people, no. It's making someone's lifestyle synonymous with a negative word,
right.
Like with, you know, dumb or stupid or whatever, immoral.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Suzanne Fields in her column was doing to atheists. And yeah, because, you know, there's another attack in the column where she says, with an eye on Nazism, Winston Churchill once said, if you replace God, you fill that with the devil. I'm not reading the quote exactly how it was, but it was something just like that. So, first of all, it's historically inaccurate to compare Nazism to atheism. But then it's like degrading to have to even get in that conversation. See, a lot of people like to say Hitler was an atheist. He wasn't an atheist. But the point is, what you're trying to say by saying Hitler was an atheist is he's the personification of evil, and I think you're the person, you know, you're yes. evil. That it's just a nanny nanny boo boo kind of thing. I mean, you know, the real life Dracula, wasn't he Christian? Does that mean that all Christians are evil because Dracula was a Christian? No way.
Right. No, and by responding so reasonably, you're really giving some kind of currency to those claims, and you're allowing them to continue, because then the editors think, oh, this was great. We had an interesting debate in our letters column. Let's publish more by this writer, because it's good for discussion.
Right. I've got to say, personally, I've seen, you know, we work closely with the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers. I've done some PR before where I've put Jason Torpy and Kathleen Johnson, who were atheists who served in foxholes, so to speak, you know, in the media to talk about this canard, this false statement that there are no atheists in foxholes. I got to admit, though, part of me always kind of felt like, geez, are we overreacting? Are we overreacting a little bit? Or, you know, is this really the most important issue that we should be right. focusing on? I got to tell you, though, Matt, when I read it in my own local newspaper, I experienced it slightly differently. But I will tell you, the most offensive part of it is not that I feel like my worldview was attacked. I feel like my sense of fairness, you know, in the media was attacked. Like, I always felt that the Times Union was very fair and reasonable. And it's not, I feel like it has a double standard when it comes to atheism in this case.
I think that was what set me off, and maybe that was why some other leaders didn't feel the same way, because I know these editors and we work with them and they're very positive to us. So really they have no excuse, and they don't publish. They have a diversity of opinions. They have a lot of conservative columnists and a lot of liberal columnists, but they don't publish people like Ann Coulter. They don't publish hate speech. They would never denigrate an entire group in the way that this writer did with the non-religious. So I really felt they were crossing a boundary I've never seen them cross before.
I tried to make that point that I don't feel like you would let another, you know, you wouldn't, because the opinion editor responded that, look, you're making a huge leap to say we wouldn't publish a column that made these same points about another group. She said we have to look at the context. And I agree with her. You do have to look at the contexts. But I sent it back to her replacing the words. Let me read it the way it was written, and then let me replace the words. There are no atheists in foxholes, as any dog-faced soldier could tell you, and neither are there many atheists in politics. Looking death in the face, whether in a foxhole or at the polls, makes a believer of almost everyone. You could ask almost any Democrat. Democratic office seekers are drenching their campaigns in religiosity, if not necessarily authentic religion. Be prepared to hear a lot more about the, and this is in scare quotes, religious left. So, I mean, it's a little bit silly to do this, but there are no gays in foxholes, as any dog-faced soldier could tell you, and neither are there many gays in politics. Looking death in the face, whether in a foxhole or at the polls, makes a straight person out of almost everyone. You can ask any Democrat. Democratic office seekers are drenching their campaigns in heterosexuality, if not necessarily authentic heterosexuality. Be prepared to hear a lot more about the straight left. I mean, it's gratuitous and ridiculous, right?
Yes. I mean, taking away the fact that the U.S. Army doesn't actually want gays in foxholes, when you put any of a term, whether it's gay or Jewish or Muslim or black or female, it jumps out at you as like this would not appear in any mainstream media. It's just
right.
beyond the pale.
Right.
And yet, if it's atheist, it seems to be okay.
I want to hear Jess's take on this. Jess, I feel like a lot. It's popular for people to try to come up with a way for showing how they're the victim of something. And I've been really upset over this week, and I want you to add your respect. Like, Are we seeking to be the victims here? Are we making a mountain out of a molehill? I mean, you deal with issues of being a free thinker, but you also deal with being gay and you face discrimination for being gay. So you tell me, do you think that if atheists get really upset about this, they're playing victim, they're making a mountain out of a molehill, or what's your take?
I don't think that gay people are, you know, by far not the only group of people who are discriminated against. And I don't think that any one form of discrimination is more important or more serious or needs to be addressed, you know, more quickly, I guess, unless someone's life is at, you know, is at stake. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that you're making a mountain of a molehill at all. And I think it makes sense. It's good that you replaced gay and right. with straight, because it's true. But you might have also seen that, you know, not so long ago. So I guess that's the point. You know, at one point we would have been having the same argument before, you know, having gay versus straight.
I think it's also a fine distinction, because you still see that stuff in non-mainstream media, and you still see it in the letters page to some extent.
Right.
The letters page has, you know, they allow more license there.
Right.
But you don't see it on the opinion page of respectable newspapers.
Right.
So
right.
I think if you look at the progress that's been made, often the atheists are one of the slower groups to get the kind of understanding and protection from mainstream society.
Matt, thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with us about this.
You're welcome.
See you soon.
People say in the USA that they don't believe in evolution. They're trying to say we were fated one day, but they're living in a mass delusion.
That song was called Some Kind of Heaven by the band The Atheists from the UK, and you can check them out on myspace.com/TheAtheistsUK.
Okay, people, so what do you think? I'm still not sure. Am I making a mountain out of a molehill here? Should I be picking this battle? You know, am I being overly sensitive? Why don't you call the HNN listener comment line at 206-339-4168. Let us know what you think about this. Let me know if you think I'm overreacting. Share your horror stories about your own local newspaper. If you don't want to call our listener comment line, if you can't get to a phone, you can send us an email at editor@humaniststudies.org. Some of the things I've been working on here at the Institute to combat this sort of anti-atheist bias, or at least to ensure that atheists get fair coverage in the media, I'm setting up a media resource page on the humaniststudies.org website, and that will give reporters some tips on how to be sensitive and respectful to atheists. I'll link to some important studies about atheism and statistics. I'm also working on an initiative to encourage newspapers to rename their religion section to be more inclusive of humanists and other non-religious people who have values. So instead of calling it the religion page, I'm hoping that some papers will pick up religion and values and invite humanists to participate.
Speaking of humanist values, this coming April, the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, in conjunction with the Secular Student Alliance, will be hosting a conference called The New Humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really the humanist conference of a lifetime, as Duncan likes to call it. and it's this April, the 20th through the 22nd.
And some of the greatest thinkers of our time are going to be there, Jess.
You mean besides you and me, of course. We've got novelist Salman Rushdie, a Nobel laureate, Amartya Sen, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning scientist E.O. Wilson, and renowned psychology professor and author Steven Pinker.
And Lori Lipman Brown, who I mentioned earlier in the show, the congressional lobbyist for the Secular Coalition for America, will be there to speak about how humanists can become more active in politics.
And singer-songwriter Dar Williams will be performing a private concert for the conference.
The website is thenewhumanism.org. Check it out. Register. Hurry up, because it's fast approaching. I helped Greg Epstein and the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard with their press release, and I've learned that there's going to be some very significant positive coverage of this conference and the chaplaincy in the media, just to follow up with our theme of humanism in the press. I have been curious about what Greg Epstein does as a humanist chaplain for several years since he started. And I've always wanted to interview him, and I finally got the chance to. One of the questions I had was, you know, humanism is referred to as non-religious, so you know, it seems like a chaplain is a religious position. I'm wondering what kind of humanism is going on at Harvard. So Jess and I traveled to the hallowed halls of Harvard to meet with Greg in the Memorial Chapel. Came complete with organs and organ music and bells. Here's Greg.
It's certainly a unique job, and most people really don't know that there has been a humanist chaplain here at Harvard for over 30 years now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are curious, what exactly does a humanist chaplain do? We like to say that the humanist chaplaincy is dedicated to building, educating, and nurturing a diverse community mm-hmm. of humanists, agnostics, atheists, and the non-religious at Harvard and beyond. Nurturing is a very important aspect of chaplaincy work. It's people have real emotional needs around issues of birth, death, struggles in life, mm-hmm. depression, anxiety, but also the joys of life, having somebody to share those with, having a community of people to share those with. So I do a lot of counseling for people around both the happy and the sad times in life. Mm-hmm. So working with students is a big part of the job, but it's also working with faculty. Mm-hmm. Anything from sometimes I'll get a fairly well-known faculty member that will come to me saying, I'd like to have you perform my wedding.
Right.
Or another faculty member came to me recently. His wife was sick with cancer, and he was really having trouble coping mm-hmm. with the struggle to support his wife and maintain his own work and his own sense of calm in the storm of not knowing what would happen to his partner. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of problems that we can't just solve in the classroom.
Right. Are you addressing the concerns of humanists in a religious context by being a humanist chaplain?
Is humanism a religion? Uh-huh. Is certainly a question that comes up a lot. I think that humanism is a life stance. Mm-hmm. A life stance is something that functions sociologically like a religion, its role in people's lives, the way that people draw on humanism as an inspiring life stance, meaning that it's not just a philosophy. You know, humanism is not just what we think. It's not just our abstract ideas about the nature of the universe. It's also the way that we live on mm-hmm. a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And so the reason we have a chaplaincy here at Harvard is to acknowledge that this is a broad and diverse community where people have real everyday, day-to-day needs beyond simply answering academic questions in the laboratory or in the classroom. And whether you happen to believe in God or not, you still have those kinds of needs, and there needs to be an institution that's dedicated to serving people in their struggles with those needs, in their dealing with those needs. We in the humanist movement rejected, back in sort of the beginning of the 20th century, this idea that we should have any institution that even seems similar to a religious institution because it's too similar to religion. And so we got rid of basically everything in the church service except for the sermon, right? And so much of humanist programming can be giving a lecture. Well, then what happens is you lose the best community organizers that you have because the job of clergy has always been to organize a community. And so what I do is I meet with students, I meet with members of the faculty, I meet with members of the community, and I talk with them about humanism mm-hmm. and about how they can get involved in the community here. We have all kinds of meetings. We do arts and cultural things. At the conference, we're making a big point of not just having lectures, and we're going to have all these wonderful lectures on humanism in different world cultural contexts, the Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen on Indian humanism, Salman Rushdie on humanistic Islam, Rabbi Sherwin Wine on humanistic Judaism. But we're also going to have concerts like Dar Williams, the very humanistic folk and rock singer, mm-hmm. is going to play a concert for us because we're expressing that artistic aspect of things. We have parties and social meetings. We sometimes will get together and sing or read some poetry. There's a wide range of activities the way that any community would have, and it's a matter of organizing that community.
Now, you have a background in music, and you were talking recently about in the earlier part of this 20th century, humanists wanted to reject all things religious. We dropped everything but the sermon. We've had Julia Sweeney on this show before talking about, you know, letting go of God. One of her biggest regrets, though, was not having access to Sunday school mm-hmm. for her daughter, not having access to a community where she can sing in the choir or you know, go on the picnics, Sunday picnics, things like that. Mm-hmm. It seems like you're trying to reintroduce some of those elements to humanism. It seems like humanism, one thing I hear is that that's the glaring omission to organized humanism is the community, the artistic side, the almost the spiritual side of humanism. How do you address that?
We humanists need to affirm and find ways to uplift the human spirit. Mm-hmm. Spirituality means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I would say that if you feel comfortable with the word spirituality in a naturalistic, non-theistic context, then by all means use it.
Yeah.
But it's the word isn't the important thing. What's important is that we get beyond humanism as a sort of disembodied head. This idea, and this is what happened with the article in Wired magazine back in November.
The new atheism.
Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, the unholy trinity, mm-hmm. as a former professor of mine at Harvard Divinity School calls them.
And the subhead line of that article.
The subheading of that article, right, was no heaven, no hell, just science.
Right.
And the thing about that is, you know, we humanists really do believe that there's no heaven and no hell. And that's a positive for us because it really makes us want to live the best lives that we can in this world.
Right.
And we do take science very, very seriously. And I have only the greatest respect for the wonderful scientific work done by my colleagues, E.O. Wilson and Steven Pinker, for example, who are both members of the board of the Humanist Chaplaincy and who will be speaking at our conference, and Richard Dawkins, and all down the line. But Duncan, don't you think human life is about more than just science?
I feel that way. I feel that I've been working this movement for a while, and I feel that that's a glaring omission. I miss that. I'm interested in speaking about art and music. And
humanism began as a response to traditional religion, appropriately so, because as we know, the wars that tore Europe apart for centuries were religious wars. And humanism evolved to do what I would say two things really well: to speak and to debate, to lecture and to argue its position. And by the way, I don't say that derogatorily, because these are both very important things. If we weren't able to speak out about what humanism is intellectually, and if we weren't able to debate with and respond to humanism's enemies, we would be nowhere. And so this was a very important movement at the beginning of the century, but what happened is that religion evolved. Mm-hmm. It changed. It's a moving target, as some would now say. And humanism for the 21st century needs to do two things in addition to speaking and debating. Not that we need to stop speaking out about who we are or stop arguing, but now a humanism for the 21st century needs also to sing and to build. By building, I mean that humanism needs to build a community, that we humanists need to build one another up rather than simply tearing down religion. But I also mean it literally, that we need humanist buildings. Mm. I really respect that that's something that you can say about the Institute for Humanist Studies, is that you actually literally have a physical building in which you can do all kinds of wonderful activities. And I think it's no accident that you guys are one of the most dynamic forces in the humanist world, because you have that space where talented people can express themselves. Mm. We need our own buildings where we can bring together all of the talent, all of the artistic, all of the creativity, all of the wonderful minds that we have to be human together.
Right.
So we need to sing and to build. We also need to sing. We need to make the experience of being part of the humanist community sing on a metaphorical level, to be able to read poetry together and to sort of see the emotional side of life. But we also need to sing literally. Mm-hmm. Like you said, with Julia, you know, to have those choruses, to a song like John Lennon's Imagine, great example. What we've had up until this point with the speaking and the debating, it's the way that I would refer to it, it's the head of humanism. Mm-hmm. And the head is very important. But if we can speak metaphorically for a moment here, what we really need to explore is the heart of humanism.
Yeah.
And if a chaplaincy at a well-known institution like Harvard can help people to begin to pioneer some of those ideas, to explore them, to imagine them, to build them, then I'm very happy to help facilitate that.
Greg, you're putting together a once-in-a-lifetime conference here at Harvard this April. And one of the announcements you're going to make are your plans with the chaplaincy to expand and create other similar programs. Can you elaborate a little bit on that to give people a teaser before you make the announcement at the conference?
In just a few months, we are hoping to introduce, thanks to in part a grant by the Institute for Humanist Studies, mm-hmm. the first ever Introduction to Humanism course at
full
the Harvard. For full credit, open to all Harvard students, undergraduate and from all the graduate school. People are ready to learn more about humanism. And so we can use the resources intellectually at Harvard to train students. Mm-hmm. One day we envision having scholarships to provide for them in exchange for going out and becoming humanist chaplains at mm-hmm. different universities. We've talked to people. We know that there are people at Yale, Stanford, Princeton, down the line, all the great schools in this country that would be interested in hosting a humanist chaplain. It's simply a matter of identifying the leadership, identifying some modest funding to begin with, and then mm-hmm. having a plan for building up the funding as we go. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can see real humanist communities mm-hmm. that can sing and build cropping up all over the country based on the leadership of a generation of humanist chaplains.
Well, you praise him, then you thank him, till you reach the by and by. And I've won hundreds at the track, but I'm not betting on the afterlife. Then you kiss his lips, he forgives you for it, he forgives you for all you've done, but not me.
That song was Big Guns by Jenny Lewis and the Watson Twins. You can check them out at jennylewis.com. Before that was a segment with Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard. And the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard will be hosting the New Humanism, which is a conference that is in light of the 30th anniversary of the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard, this April 20th through the 22nd. Now, the cost for the full conference is $204 if you're over 30 years old. If you're under 30, the cost is $25 to $50, depending on your affiliation. Now, the Secular Student Alliance, who is hosting this in conjunction with the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy, is making travel grants available. So, but spots are filling up, so hurry up and register that. You can get those travel grants through the Secular Student Alliance website, which is secularstudents.org.
Yep, and you can learn more about the conference at thenewhumanism.org. So when I was talking to Greg, he was emphasizing that humanists come from all different cultural backgrounds, and they enrich our humanist fold by bringing in elements from their various cultural backgrounds. Humanists come in all shapes and sizes. Humanists also have various sexual orientations. In the next segment, we're going to sit in on an intergenerational conversation between three women who are lesbians and who are also feminists. Jess will be our tour guide.
As many of you know, Judy Disco and I are co-workers here at the Institute for Humanist Studies. As a morning ritual, I look forward to stopping by Judy's office on my way upstairs to discuss a popular show where the majority of the characters are lesbians. We have polar opposite views on the issues that come up during the show, and we suspect it's because of our generational differences. So to get to the bottom of this, and because it's Women's History Month, I've invited Judy, along with our mutual friend, Lori Mose, to share their experiences in same-sex relationships, as well as their views on the many factors surrounding lesbianism and feminism. So just to clarify, I'm 25, Lori's 30, and Judy is, well, let's just say Judy's over 30.
So, you know, we would come in, I said, oh, it's just the L word yet, and then we'd like to start talking about different things and different words. And, you know, she would identify as gay, and I said, oh, that's very interesting. And I said, you know, from my politics, gay was always identified as male. And for lesbian feminists coming, you know, from the late 70s or the early 80s, anybody who identified as a lesbian feminist would not identify as gay.
A gay woman, a feminist lesbian, and a dyke walk into a bar. Now, as ridiculous as that might sound, here's why it's really important that we're able to self-identify.
To me, it's taking back the word that so many people have put a negative connotation on.
Absolutely.
And just...
Yeah, I also identify as dyke.
Yeah.
I like but dyke. Not a gay woman.
No.
What's the connotation that dyke used to have? Like, was it a woman trying to be a man?
I think it was a woman trying to be a man, or just a very negative woman that's like a man hater and just not at all.
It wasn't a positive.
Right,
thing.
Not at all.
It's actually, dyke is what queer today,
mm-hmm.
and how if you talk to us many times, like an older person does not want to use the term queer,
right.
because that has a negative connotation, just like dyke did like 25 years ago,
right.
had a real negative connotation. So, you know, a lot of the lesbians from that era brought dyke back,
right.
and a lot of the younger people today are bringing queer back into the picture.
I'm bringing sexy back.
Yeah, yes, you are.
You are?
Justin Timberlake has a song, I'm Bringing Sexy Back.
Oh, okay.
So, Lori, you identify as a dyke.
I do.
And Judy, you said a lesbian feminist. Now, is...
Lesbian feminist dyke.
Okay. And if a woman who is homosexual but is not political, are they still a lesbian?
I think many women who identify as gay are not political.
Mm-hmm.
Or do not have feminist politics.
Right. I think a lot of the younger generation that are identifying as quote-unquote queer, any kind of queer, be it bi, transgender,
not
lesbian,
heterosexual.
Right, not heterosexual. They have really gone away from the political movement, and that's kind of sad.
It is sad. People from older times forget what we've gone through. And
we don't know.
And right, it's true. And the younger generation doesn't know. And, you know, kind of paved the way so that a lot of things could be happening for people today.
It's kind of, if you think about women's suffrage,
mm-hmm.
and now how young girls don't go out and vote,
right,
and they don't realize how many women died.
That's right.
Died for that right.
That's right.
Before you're able to become politically active in any issue that's important to you, women's suffrage or same-sex marriages, first you have to come to terms with who you are on the inside. And for a lot of us, that starts with the coming out process.
When I was 18, I was in San Francisco for a summer, and I had an affair with another woman. There was no political consciousness around that, and I just thought it was free love, drugs, sex, rock and roll. I was having a great time. And then I came back to Massachusetts and got married to my high school sweetheart. And
a man, obviously, right? Because you got married.
It was a man.
Okay.
And you know, and I always had these like really strong female relationships and attractions to women, but I kind of like buried it. So then I made the decision. Well, I got divorced. I made the decision to move to Albany, and I wanted to finish up my degree. And I needed another course to fill my course load, and I saw Intro to Feminism. And I thought, easy 3 credits. I'm a feminist. Well, the course changed. It changed my life. I mean, within like 3 minutes, I was out. You know, that was it. And you know, I just realized feminism from a much more radical perspective.
Lori's crush on her fourth grade teacher speaks to those who identify as being born gay.
She would sit on my desk because I'm deaf, so she would sit on my desk. I was in the front row and swing her high heel, and I'd be like, oh. She would read Beverly Cleary to us. Anyway, I digress. normalization hit. I got married. 5 years of torture later, I divorced him, and moved back home and started dating a woman who was married to the chief of police of the small town that I was living in. And then finally I came out to my sister, who proceeded to say, "I'm going to tell Mom." And I said, "Okay, well, the Grand Ole Opry's on." I walked into Mom and I said, "I know you're watching a show right now, but I need to tell you something." I said, "June and I aren't friends. We're sleeping together. If you have any questions, come talk to me after the Opry." And she just kind of looked up at me and was like, "Uh-huh," and looked back at the Opry, and then I was just out from then.
That's so interesting when you say what you said to your mother. When I told my mother, she started going through all my friends that she had met. She said, "Please don't tell me you're a lesbian." I said, "Okay, I won't tell you I'm a lesbian." Then she goes, "Is Melissa a lesbian?" I said, "Uh-huh." "Is Sue a lesbian?" "Uh-huh." "Uh-huh." "Is Barbara a lesbian?" "Uh-huh." So everyone that she named, I just kept going, "Uh-huh, uh-huh." And yeah, that was it. There was never any other discussion about it afterwards.
So does the amount of time that you've been out of the closet impact how far you come out?
I think that a lot of the people that I date, well, both of you know I date older women, but they, coming from a different generation, are not as vocal about being out, and most of them came out in a time where it was not okay to say, "Hey, I'm a lesbian." So I think that it's a generational thing also, but
it is to a certain point, but I just want to make sure that even though we're from a different generation, I too have always been out, right, all over the place. I mean, it just spills all out of me. But I also came out in the university setting. It was this enormous support circle. So it was like shouting from the rooftop, "I'm a lesbian, I'm a lesbian, blah, 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 I'm this, I'm that."
I think time, but also geography has a big difference. Because nowadays, there are some kids who come out in high school and they're very proud, you know, they got their rainbow patches sewn on into their book bags, but like, you probably don't see that everywhere in the world.
Hey, Jess.
Hey, Duncan.
One of the things that I talked with you about when you first started working here, I remember we were walking down the street, and I wanted to know, as a lesbian in a committed relationship, what do you call your significant other? Because significant other is really clinical, but sometimes I think, you know, partner is kind of clinical too, right?
Right, and I actually remember you saying, whenever you hear partner, it's like, oh, they're probably gay. And it's like, that's not the case, because sometimes straight people now, right?
Yeah, for solidarity, they sometimes use the term partner.
Right,
also,
or it's
though,
professional.
It could be your business partner. Right. You don't really know what's going on. I sort of feel like, there needs to be a more affectionate term. That was the thing I was talking with you about.
Right, so have we coined a term yet?
Yeah.
And actually, Judy brings up a good point, too.
Straight women call their girlfriends
friends
call their girlfriends.
Right, right.
It's interesting because Barbara, who's my partner, you know, she said to me, "I can't imagine calling you my wife." I said, "Honey, you're not calling me your wife." I said, "I'm not anybody's wife," you know. So I honestly don't know what.
I like partner. I think it is an endearing term. I mean, when I say it, the love that comes from it is just very, you know, it's
interesting.
It's the way you feel. It's not the actual word.
Social norms, religious beliefs, and law provide challenges when deciding what to call people we're in a relationship with, but also how many people we can be in a relationship with at once.
Why don't you explain that one?
Polyamory at its best. Karen and I are committed in our relationship, and we live together, we own a house together, we have cars together, we have dogs together. However, we choose to have an open relationship where if one or the other person feels that their physical needs are not being fulfilled in a way that they possibly should be, that we can go outside of the relationship and have sexual relations with others. Also, because she is a little bit older than I am, she's in a physical stage in her life where she doesn't really want sex all that much. She's going through menopause, and so being 23 years younger than she is, you know, I'm kind of at the peak of my sexuality, and she understands that, and it's so cool because I feel that we're together because we want to be together instead of being together because we need to be together.
Right. I have all I can do but to maintain one.
And that's the thing, is a lot of the women that I have been with, other than Karen, they don't get it.
I mean, there was a point, you know, when I was, you know, first coming out that I was non-monogamous, mm-hmm. when I was in a relationship, and it was hard because I really wanted to be with this other woman, and she said, "Oh no, go ahead, go out with this other woman." So I go out with this other woman, and all the time I'm thinking of this other person, yeah. and it's like, oh, I just want to go home. I want to be with this other person. But so it didn't really work that well for me.
So the historic feminist perspective is that some types of relationships, like polyamory, are okay, but polygamy is not okay. Is that right, Duncan?
Well, according to some of my former girlfriends, polygamy, which would be, you know, the husband with multiple wives, that's sexist, which I think it can be.
Right.
But polyandry, where it'd be like a woman with multiple husbands, they're like, you go, girl. So, yes, I mean, sometimes there can be kind of a double standard. I don't know how serious they were about that. But.
Right. Well, how would, if there was a double standard, how would that translate amongst same-sex couples or homosexuals, you know, as a community? Like, I think that sometimes it's okay for men to be polyamorous, but not okay for women, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So that's what we cover next.
There's a perception that in the gay male community that they always have multiple partners. But I don't know. I mean, it's a perception, and I'm not sure
that they're out at the bath.
And, you know, there may be some truth to it. I'm sure there are some men that are in monogamous relationships, but I think, but there's also more men that do have multiple sex partners.
And it's funny because the men who I know have more than one partner, mm-hmm. Or more than one sexual relationship, they even look down on Karen and myself.
Really?
Being this, they're like, because it's so traditional that lesbians are monogamous, and they get together and they love each other and they're there.
Back in the early 80s, non-monogamy was big in the lesbian feminist community because they did not, you know, women at that time did not want to fall under the, you know, the heterosexual norm. Mm. So non-monogamy was the big thing.
That's so funny that you say that, because that's one thing that Karen said to me, is I won't get married because that's a heterosexual thing to do. And I'm like, no, this is a legal thing.
Right.
This is a I want your social security if you die thing.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it doesn't have any, marriage to me is not the, let's have the big white gown and you can wear a tux and, you know, no, I want the legal protection under the law.
Right. I'm tired of every time I travel someplace having to bring my healthcare proxy, because if somebody gets sick, I want to be able, for one of us to be able to make
a decision.
A decision.
Yeah. Well, same-sex marriage is certainly a serious and worthy topic, but, you know, like Cyndi Lauper used to say, girls just want to have fun, Duncan.
Yeah, well, Jess, as people know, I play the comic relief on the show, and you're the straight man. So why don't you try to dispel that stereotype and tell us a joke?
Sounds good. So, Duncan, what do lesbians bring on the second date?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Something with batteries?
Try again. Here we go.
A U-Haul.
A turkey baster.
Oh.
Touché. Yes. A U-Haul and a turkey baster, perhaps,
and,
if you're lucky.
Yeah, latex and all that.
So have you ever had a second date, U-Haul, Lori?
I did. It was awful. Awful. Like, the night that we first dated, it was literally a second date U-Haul. So the night that we first dated, we went out to Chinese food. And her dog, I met her dog, and the next day she's like, you know, why are you spending so much money on an apartment, you could move in here. And I'm like, yeah, we had 9 months of no sex, which for Lori Ellen's not a happy thing.
No.
And then I moved down to Troy.
I always took a little longer.
Mm.
At least to the third date.
Another thing that us lesbians are infamous for is saying, I love you, rather quickly.
Oh, longer than a week. Oh, yeah. I would say probably a month before I would say, I love you.
I love you.
What are the ways that you sidestep it? I could fall in love with you. I think I'm falling in love with you. I might be falling in love with you.
Right.
I love spending time with
you're
you.
You're the type that I would fall in love with.
I could
in the future.
Exactly.
Wait,
yeah, exactly.
If I was going to fall in love with somebody, it would be someone like you.
Or I love your dog.
So many of us learned about relationships and ourselves through watching something on TV. And it wasn't until fairly recently that gay men and women were able to identify with the character that they were learning from.
When Ellen came out and everybody freaked out.
Yep.
When she came out on her sitcom,
right,
Ellen.
Right. When there was so much drama involved with one person coming out and saying that she was a lesbian, that's just when it really was like, wow, there's really not a lot of shows out there that represent who we are.
Right.
And they still don't really represent who we are. It's better to have what recognition we do have on television, but it's very stereotypical.
Right. All right, so yours was the Ellen. How about you?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of that. You know, it probably had to be around the Ellen time, because before that, we just like never really thought about it.
Right.
It just never... So that was the first awareness, I guess, for me. That...
For me, it's growing up thinking one thing, but then like after I came out, now thinking back, like Facts of Life, right, Joe?
Facts of
it's like,
Life.
Like, come on.
Joe.
Like, total dyke, right?
Yeah.
And what, I mean,
yeah, but
what
she
else?
Dated men.
I know, but...
Then she had a...
So maybe that's where a lack of lesbian, right, like where she probably should have been or could have been or maybe wanted to be. I don't know.
I would have liked to see Blair and Joe together.
It's like the classic Femme and Butch. It's right.
Well, then also Roseanne.
Yeah.
Sarah Gilbert. I mean, she was a little dyke on that show.
And then the mother came out as a lesbian also later in the show.
And in my opinion, Jackie always should have been a dyke.
Right.
Golden Girls?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What else?
Anything B. Arthur has ever done.
If you want it, come and get it. I know how much you do. If you work out, if you're worthy, I just might give it to you. I am the it girl.
That song was by the band Betty, and it was called The It Girl, which I personally like to think of as my theme song for the work that I do here at the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Because Jess is the IT person.
Correct, Duncan.
Not a webmaster.
No. Duncan got harassed by someone when he called me the webmaster.
Uh-huh.
They said he was sexist.
Yeah.
At any rate, so the segment before that, though, was... it was my coworker Judy Disco, who you all know, our mutual friend Lori Mose, and me. And we would love your feedback about that segment. It's the first time we've sort of done anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So call our listener comment line, please, at 206-339-4168. Again, we would love to discuss anything. If you have any questions or if you want to share your own coming out story.
All coming out stories are welcome, but if you have an outrageous coming out story, Jess and I would particularly like to hear from you, because we're working on a collection, a series called Now That You're Over It. And I think that maybe some outrageous coming out stories, like just debacles, humorous, preferably.
That's right. Do you remember the one that I told you about? Not my own coming out story.
Yeah,
but
the coming out that you were sort of an accomplice to.
That's right.
unwilling accomplice to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right. So call our listener comment line 206-339-4168. And also I should mention that Judy and Lori both serve on the board of our local community center for the gay and lesbian community. And their website is cdglcc.org, and that stands for the Capital District Gay and Lesbian Community Council. And I know that Judy and Lori would love to also have a discussion with any of you or serve as a resource and refer you if you need any sort of help in that area.
All right, and to round out our show, I got a chance to interview Jennifer Lang yesterday.
Yeah.
She is the...
Legislative
liaison
go,
for the
nice
Institute
job,
for humanist studies. We're all learning to say legislative liaison around here. It was Jennifer's first day on the job, so Jess and I thought we might haze her a little bit by sticking a microphone in her face. That's what we do around here. Jennifer is going to be lobbying on behalf of the Institute, and she's sort of picking up where Tim Gordonier left off here, and some of you listeners might remember him from being on our show a few months ago. Jennifer, what does it mean to be a legislative liaison? What types of work will you be doing for us?
Well, what I'll be primarily doing is working with the New York State Legislature, doing lobbying issues such as mainstream issues that IHS is involved in, emergency contraceptives, stem cell research, and also branding our name, mm-hmm. philosophy, and what we do.
Mm-hmm. So working, these issues are already out there. Groups like Family Planning Advocates, Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood, they're lobbying the legislature on some of these issues too, but you're going to be supporting them and letting folks know that, hey, the humanists care about these issues too. These are really important, right?
Exactly. I think that by building a coalition with groups that we agree on important issues mm-hmm. will help us in being more familiar to the representatives mm-hmm. in New York State.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is your background? You worked in the legislature for 5 years, I believe.
Yes, I did. I worked for an assembly member in Buffalo mm-hmm. For 3 years. I was in Buffalo, and I did his community and also his I was part of his political team, excuse me. Uh-huh. And then in Albany, I was his legislative director, where I did his legislative initiatives, drafting, funding, and also met with lobbyists on different mm-hmm. issues.
So what's it like to be, like what insight do you bring to lobbying as someone who was lobbied?
Well, I think what I bring is the time issue, the points, and how we want to stay on task mm-hmm. and make sure that we're going in there professional, we're going in on something that we want. Mm-hmm. We want to either educate, inform, or support an issue, a piece of legislation, mm-hmm. a topic. So I understand what it is we're doing when we go in, and specifically how to relate with the legislator yeah. or the staff member.
Something that's been in the news lately is Congress member Pete Stark in California recently came out as a person who does not believe in God. And I was just wondering, do you think that there are any, we don't have any openly non-theistic legislators in New York, but do you think that there are any humanists in the closet in our legislature?
There absolutely are humanists in the closet. Mm-hmm. It's bringing them out, I think, which will be a challenge, at least openly. Uh-huh. I think that behind closed door there is support.
Yeah.
I think it's on the way that we approach the members individually as well as the group or the topic that we're advocating on behalf.
Because I read a lot of people quote the American Mosaic Project and the Free Thought Movement. It's the study that found that atheists are the least trusted belief group in the country. And there was a Gallup poll recently that said that like less than half of the country would vote for a qualified presidential candidate if he or she were an atheist. But that Mosaic Project also found that the East Coast and the West Coast are more friendly, more accepting of non-belief or humanism than other parts of the country. So you would think that maybe New York would be a place where we could have a legislator who could come out and not fear retribution, but I don't know. What do you think? Is it really a hostile climate, even in New York?
I definitely think it would be a hostile climate in uh-huh. New York, but I think as far as the East Coast, we have Mitt Romney was yeah. able to get elected. We have right. Schumer, now we have Spitzer, so we definitely have people of different religions.
So Romney, Mormon, Spitzer, and
Schumer.
Schumer, Jewish?
Correct.
Okay. Well, we have a few openly gay legislators?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So I think that on the East Coast, we absolutely have been able to diversify our legislators, our representatives. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would like to do is be able to make it apparent that humanists are moral, they have values, they're strong.
Patriotic, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely patriotic, mainstream.
Well, Jen, I understand that you also, before going into politics, you were active in the Peace Corps, and I I want to learn more about that, so I'm going to have you back on the show very soon to talk about that and some other issues as they arise. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this month. A special note to our diehard listeners out there. Jess and I may be a little bit late putting out our show next month because we're going to be at the conference at Harvard.
So you can come meet us in person.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about hosting your own website for your humanist group, how to get PR, and how to do a podcast. But if you can't make it to the Harvard conference, we understand. Make sure you call our listener comment line at 206-339-4168.
You can also read about maybe what we learn about at the conference or you know whatever we talk about on our podcast on our podcast page, which is humaniststudies.org/podcast.
There you can find links to transcripts from previous shows and links to previous episodes. Don't forget to read our weekly e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org.
And our theme music was generously donated by Holly Near. You can get more information at hollynear.com.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Thanks for listening.